Number 10-30092, United States versus Zamora and Freeman, and hear from our good friend, Mr. Aberley.
Good morning. I represent Fletcher Freeman, co-defendant in this case. At the end of this four-day trial, the government's case agent told the jury that my client, Mr. Freeman, has a criminal history. Now, Mr. Freeman has argued in his brief this statement was unsolicited, inadmissible. The more involved question that I'd like to address is whether it was harmless.
Did someone object to that?
Counsel objected when the witness sat down and moved for mistrial.
What did the court rule?
The court agreed with the government in this case that the defendant had basically invited the question, the answer. As we've argued in the brief, we don't even begin to see how that was invited.
But court didn't instruct the jury to disregard?
No, because the court felt that it was a fair statement in light of it being invited.
All right.
Was it embellished any other point that the government harped on it, was mentioning closing argument? Was that the one and only time?
That was the one and only time. And the government's position is that this unspecified mention of this man's criminal history is not so prejudicial given the backdrop of this four-day trial and 39 witnesses and 200 exhibits. But I think what makes the bigness of this trial important in this case is several things. First, other than Agent Thomas's comment, the only incriminating testimony that came from that was the only incriminating testimony that came from any of 21 law enforcement officers. Number two, there's really no physical evidence in this case, with the arguable exception of a document showing that a car that had been stopped with cocaine in it had once belonged to Mr. Freeman. That's not particularly probative in this case, given that the person who actually purchased this car testified that she went to Georgia, where Mr. Freeman has always been and never have left. She bought it from either him or Mr. Stinson. Mr. Stinson, we know, is the purchaser of all drugs brought to Georgia. The question is whether Mr. Freeman was his partner. And given that Mr. Freeman and Mr. Stinson have a relationship that involves actual employment and they're actually related family-wise, it's not surprising to see that a car that he once owned may have ended up in this conspiracy, particularly since there's also evidence that there are a lot of cars in this conspiracy that were registered to innocent people. The other piece of documentary evidence is a phone number that was found on Miguel Puente that he says was the phone number of Mr. Freeman. Miguel Puente is an interesting character. He gave testimony about his deliveries of cocaine to Georgia directly to Mr. Freeman. It conflicted with all the other witnesses on how cocaine was delivered to Georgia. You'll notice it's not in the record, but you could take judicial notice that the area code that is with this phone number ceased to exist in 2001 before the conspiracy was even alleged to begin. The third thing about this being a big trial that actually weighs in Mr. Freeman's favor is all of those witnesses who incriminated him, either mildly or quite extensively, with the one exception of the tow truck driver, were all criminals convicted, waiting sentencing reductions. These witnesses gave testimony, as we've noted in the brief, that's inconsistent with each other, and many of them were housed together pre-trial. The final point about this being a big trial was there was a large number of witnesses who delivered cocaine to Georgia who you would think would have known Mr. Freeman if Mr. Freeman was involved, as they said, and they didn't recognize him. So, yes, this was a big trial. There was lots of evidence presented to this jury over 4 days, 39 witnesses, lots of activities between Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, and Georgia. Very little of it involved Mr. Freeman.
And how many defendants actually went to trial?
Two.
Yeah, just Freeman and Zamora?
Yes.
Okay.
And there's nothing that at this trial that makes these, in fact, none of the witnesses even seem to overlap in this case. The other thing to note is that after the morning of the third day of trial, Mr. Freeman's name is not mentioned again. So there's another day and a half of trial where this jury is hit with all these witnesses and all this evidence, and Mr. Freeman is suddenly in the background. And then, right when the trial ends, they hear from Agent Thomas that Mr. Freeman has a criminal history. That's what they take to the jury room. That's the last thing in their mind. No admonition from the court, who didn't see anything wrong with this this testimony. So,
well, you said that the district court thought it was invited. Did anybody request an admonition?
Well, Mr. Freeman moved for a mistrial, and the court made it clear that it was going to grant a mistrial because there wasn't even an error involved here. There's the general instructions that you get it during jury instructions that that may have covered this, but nothing addressing this particular matter. I don't think it was asked for in light of the court's ruling.
What's the best case you have for something similar where, we had a remark that sort of been dispositive here? I mean, as you well know, there often we have cases where, there are comments made, et cetera, et cetera. And I get your point that in the scheme of this, this other evidence, but you've got one best case?
Best decision?
Well, yeah, that helps you in terms of
The
remark standing out to a point that, becomes reversible error.
Well, of course, the trouble with these cases is that every one of them has a different, completely different fact pattern. Of course, we relied on Old Chief for the general propositions, and I think...
Well, many of the cases, as you know, it probably would be that there's other evidence where the defendant is connected, so the case is going to say, well, it's just a remark, but the jury had other evidence.
Yeah.
Your argument is that there isn't a whole lot of other evidence. There's this remark, so therefore it has more probative work. So I was just asking you as you wind down, if there is a case you point to that's more similar to yours, where it isn't that we've got the DNA, this
yes.
is just one comment, but where this comment takes on so much more probative work from your standpoint,
right.
That's all.
And I'm not prepared to give a specific case, although I can say that there are cases that are, I believe, cited in the brief, perhaps in the footnote, that indicate that where the evidence ultimately is merely credibility. If that's what the jury has basically left to decide, then something that affects the defendant's credibility wrongly makes it so the error cannot be harmless.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. You have time for rebuttal. Mr. Bevins.
Good morning. May it please the court. Thomas J. Bevins for Mr. Roberto Zamora. In our brief, we raised four issues, one of which was Mr. Zamora's role in the offense. I think that issue is moot since he received a sentence of 10-year mandatory minimum. There have been pretty much one theme of the defense of Mr. Zamora in this case. At trial, at the conclusion of the government's case in chief, trial counsel made a motion for a motion of a judgment of acquittal. He also made a similar motion at the end of the trial, and then submitted a written motion at the end of the trial for a motion of acquittal and a new trial. This issue was again brought up by us on appeal. The government's case in chief connects Mr. Zamora to the conspiracy charge in this case to the fact that when Mr. Zamora was arrested on April 4th, 2006, he was in possession of a 2000 VW vehicle that had been used by the conspirators in 2005. A lady was arrested with the VW in South Texas on March 5th, 2005, at which time some cocaine was found in the car. The car was subsequently seized, forfeited, and sold. So the car was out of circulation as of March 11th in 2005. Then we skip over for a full year and is found in possession of Mr. Zamora in Houston on April 4th, 2006. So therefore, our contention is that once the car was seized, forfeited, and sold, it was no longer an instrument of transportation being used by the conspirators charged in the indictment. So our argument basically is that there is absolutely no connection to Mr. Zamora with the original conspirators. Lieutenant Valdez of the Jim Wells Sheriff's Office testified that the car was sold. And there's no evidence as to whom the car was sold and who subsequently registered the car. So we have a period of approximately 13 months where we really don't know what the use of the car was used for, or who had it, or what was the use, or was it actually used again for the conspirators. Then the government goes ahead and based the fact that Mr. Zamora had this VW, and then they try to bolster their argument by inferences. They say, well, he had the conspirators had the VW. He had the VW. The VW had been taken out of circulation. They say that the method of operation is the same, that the car was left at a the car was left at a store, and apparently Mr. Zamora picked up the car and took it home. They say that the Galleria was used as a drop-off in similar cases. The fact that there was a weapon in the house, this is a common practice. One of the cars found in Mr. Zamora's driveway had Mexican plates. This is not uncommon in this neighborhood in Houston. They also mentioned that some of the facts that Mr. Zamora had a ledger where he had the word Gordo in it. Gordo is a common name used by
means fatty.
Yeah, yes, I'm sorry. And it applies to a lot of us. Another inference that I believe that is in favor of Mr. Zamora is that all the other people seem to know each other. And the inference is that none of these people testified that they knew Mr. Zamora, the co-conspirators. And it's quite common in this type of situation that people, they use family, they use friends, they're all from the same small towns in South Texas or Mexico, and they all knew each other, and they all trust each other. The people in Georgia didn't know Mr. Zamora, and the people in South Texas didn't know Mr. Zamora.
Well, his brother knew him. Did his brother plead out?
Pardon, ma'am?
His brother, Leobardo, was he involved in this?
Yes, he was arrested with his brother.
Yeah.
So basically what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, that Mr. Zamora was a dope dealer, but Mr. Zamora was not a dope dealer in the conspiracy that is charged in this indictment. And therefore, if the conspiracy drops, the gun charge against him should also drop.
But there was a Gordo in this conspiracy also.
Pardon?
Wasn't, There was a Gordo in this conspiracy.
No.
You say there's no
evidence. They found a ledger. They found a ledger in his house.
In his house.
Okay.
Right.
And one of the notations on the ledger, I guess it stated that Gordo owed them money, or they were going to deliver to Gordo or something. But it's not clear. The only connection is the car, and the car is not an instrument of the conspiracy that Mr. Zamora may have been involved in.
Wouldn't there have been evidence that the drug traffickers would be interested in purchasing something like this from a forfeiture sale because it was already configured for their purposes?
We don't know. There's no evidence.
No evidence of
there's
that.
There's no evidence of who bought the car and who used the car for 13 months, and then it ends up in Zamora's driveway.
Okay, you have time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Main.
May it please the court. I'm Camille Domang. I represent the United States, who's the appellee in this matter. And I'll begin by discussing the issue raised by Mr. Freeman in his brief, which basically relates to the inadvertent, and I don't think there's any accusation that the agent intentionally, you know, tried to blurt this out. In fact, the question that was posed to him on the issue of the prior record was, and this was posed by defense counsel, quote, is it a fact that other authorities in Georgia investigated Mr. Freeman and rejected charges on him? I mean, this is obviously sort of a broad, nonspecific question. It was, and obviously counsel was trying to establish that somebody else had looked at the evidence and didn't think it was sufficient to go forward with the charge. But of course, we all know there are lots of reasons why a particular jurisdiction may elect not to charge a defendant, particularly where there's a possibility that some other jurisdiction may charge that defendant. And I mean, we don't know. We didn't get that far into the testimony because, as Judge Stewart pointed out, the line of questioning was abandoned. The agent was asked the question. His response was, I don't know, but he has some other criminal history other than what he's in court for here. And then defense counsel says, now, he wasn't ever convicted of anything, was he? And the agent said, no. I think he said either no or not that I know of or no, not that I believe. Not that I know of, no, sir. That was his response. And that was the end of it. No one ever went back to it. There was never a request, to answer your question, Judge Southwick, for a curative or a limiting instruction. No one ever brought this up in closing argument, in redirect. There was never any more conversation about this issue of the criminal record. Defense counsel did move for mistrial. And what the district court basically said was, you know, the agent's entitled to explain his answer. He, you know, this question was asked. The answer was reasonably responsive, which is our first argument in our brief. And the agent's entitled to answer the question. And so the court just basically said, you know, I'm going to deny the mistrial. He's entitled to answer the question. There was no request for a limiting instruction, no request for a curative instruction, although the court did give the general instruction at the conclusion of trial that the defendant is only on trial for the conduct alleged in the indictment. And so he wouldn't be on trial for anything else that, you know, might have been in this sort of vague criminal history. Going to the issue of whether this is harmless or harmful error, it's our position that, you know, in this four-day trial with 200 exhibits and lots of witnesses, you know, testifying about going here and bundles of cocaine and hidden compartments and Georgia and Texas, that this one minuscule reference to this vague criminal history was harmless error.
Did it really take 39 witnesses to incriminate both of these defendants?
It did, Your Honor, because of your question was how many defendants went to trial too. But there were originally something like 9 individuals charged.
Well,
it's a broad conspiracy that involved some activity in Houston, some activity in Georgia, and of course the Western District of Louisiana is in the middle, so a lot of this was going through our district, and that's how we end up getting venue. And so, yes, it did, because we're basically, we've got, you know, two sort of bookends on the conspiracy, not in terms of involvement, because Mr. Freeman was significantly involved in this conspiracy. He was not a low man on the totem pole. And, you know, that sort of goes into my harmless error argument. At least 10 co-conspirators testified that I brought this guy cocaine, I saw him, I met him, and many of them identified him out of lineups. Some of them were able to identify him in open court. That included his partner, Bruce Stinson, who worked with him in this drug business for years. You know, his testimony was unequivocal about, well, yeah, I mean, I know this guy. I did business with him for years. And then you have this tow truck driver. One of the things that happens in this case is the conspirators are transporting a load of powder cocaine in a truck, and the truck breaks down in Lafayette, Louisiana, which is in the Western District of Louisiana, and they can't get the truck going again. So they hire a local tow truck service to tow the truck all the way to Columbus, Georgia. And when they get to Columbus, Georgia, the person who's there waiting for them is, among other people, there are several individuals, but one of these individuals is Mr. Freeman, who actually provides the money to a third party to provide to the tow truck driver. And, of course, the tow truck driver is just an ordinary citizen who doesn't have a criminal record. He doesn't have a plea agreement. He's not charged in the indictment. And the prosecutor asks him at trial, can you identify Mr. Freeman? And he said, absolutely, there he is. And on cross-examination, he was vigorously cross-examined. How can you be sure? And he was adamant, I am very good with faces, and that is the man. So there was substantial evidence of Mr. Freeman's involvement in this particular conspiracy. And it's our position that this was harmless error. The cases that I cite in my brief, Judge Stewart, you asked the defense counsel for his cases. Weisenbaker was a case in which a witness blurts out in the course of an examination something about, oh, back when the defendant was in trouble in Louisiana. And that was held to be harmless. It was a sort of a vague reference to something. It was not visited again in the trial. In light of the entire trial, it was harmless. Relaford, cited in my brief, involved a case where a witness blurts out the fact that the defendant had a prior arrest. That was held to be harmless. And then Elashi is a case where an audio tape played, and the audio tape had a sort of an inflammatory comment by the defendant that was supposed to have been redacted out of the tape, and it wasn't by accident, and it was played, and the jury heard it, and the court, and you know, the ruling of this court was, well, it's harmless. It was a long trial. There were lots of tapes. There was lots of testimony. So we would suggest that any error is harmless. I'll move on now to the arguments raised by Mr. Zamora, and basically rely on my brief for the arguments that he did not specifically address in his argument, unless the court has questions, and that would be the venue instruction issue. I think he's conceded that the guideline issue is probably moot in light of the fact the defendant got a mandatory minimum, and then the motion to suppress. So unless the court has specific questions on those, I'll just address the sufficiency issue. Again, this was a case involving a sort of a broad conspiracy. There was a Texas component and there was a Georgia component, but there were overlaps. You have the overlap of couriers. There were several couriers who only serviced Georgia, some who only serviced Texas, but several who serviced both places. Alberto Flores, often referred to by the nickname Ivan in the transcript, so you may see him referred to by some witnesses as Ivan Flores. He was one of these individuals who serviced both Georgia and Texas. And Mr. Flores was in turn in charge of recruiting other people as couriers, or more significantly for this conspiracy, nobody wanted the cars in their names, so Mr. Flores was in charge of recruiting people to put cars, to title cars, in their names, so that if anyone was ever stopped or arrested, the car would not come back to Pancho Chapa Duran, who's the head guy back in Mexico leading this conspiracy. And there was a particular Volkswagen Beetle that was, it's described in the testimony typically as blue. When you look at the photographs, it is like a neon purple, blue purple. I don't think there are too many of them like that. It's a fairly, you know, remarkable colored Volkswagen Beetle. And it, of course, has this built-in compartment in the dashboard that makes it ideally suited for traffic in narcotics. And if you and the government introduced the title documents showing that this car was initially titled in the name of Jessica Cortez, who was sort of an innocent dupe. She had no other involvement in the conspiracy. And then it was transferred from her to someone by the name of Angel Torres. And Angel Torres was involved in the conspiracy. He or she was a knowing member of the conspiracy. And that is the Volkswagen that is later found at Roberto Zamora's house. Now, defense counsel mentioned in his argument that, you know, suggesting that it's crystal clear on the record that this car was forfeited and sold. I would suggest to you that that is not, it's not clear in the record that this car was ever forfeited and sold. An officer from Jim Wells County who stopped the woman, Tiffany Del Bosquez, I'm not sure how she pronounces her name. She was the one driving the Volkswagen in 2005. When he stops her, he finds some cocaine in the car. He's asked on cross-examination, what happens to that Volkswagen? And his response, the response of the officer was something along the lines, I assume it was forfeited through my agency. The issue with that is, by the time we get to Roberto Zamora's house, one of the things the officers did was they ran the plates on all of the cars in Roberto Zamora's yard, including that same 2000 blue-purple Volkswagen. And it came back that there was a border watch on that particular vehicle because the vehicle had been involved in drug trafficking. Now, I would suggest to you that if the car was forfeited and sold, that there would no longer be a border watch on it because that car would have been taken out of the drug commerce, as counsel says, and would have been sold in the ordinary course of things. Now, you know, I guess my only suggestion to you is I don't think it's crystal clear on the record that that car was forfeited and sold to a third party.
Counsel, let me ask you, when you use the phrase it's not crystal clear, it makes me think maybe there's more in there than what you indicated. Is the only evidence in the record this testimony that you just mentioned?
The only evidence
of what happened to the car, some officer saying, I assume that it was forfeited?
That's the only thing in the record about what happens to the car after Tiffany Del Bosquez is stopped with it in March of 2005. The next time we see the car, it's in Roberto Zamora's yard. Now, he confesses, don't lose sight of the fact that he confesses to the officers that he acquired that car from someone, from a Mexican man. This was his statement to the police, that he bought it from a Mexican man and that he went down to the store. He doesn't say what store, but he picked it up at a store, and he knew that it was loaded with cocaine. So Zamora confesses to his knowledge of the cocaine.
That wasn't offered. That wasn't allowed in his testimony.
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
That was. Okay.
And in fact, everything at the end of the day ended up coming in. The district court suppressed a small statement. When the agents go in to execute the search, one of the officers asks, "Are there any guns in the house?" He says he does that all the time for his safety. And the response from Zamora was, "Yes, there's a gun in the west bedroom." That statement was initially suppressed, but at the end of the day, it came in because the district court found the defense had opened the door by pressing a witness on whether he had any evidence that Zamora had a connection to the west bedroom. And so the government took the position that they'd opened the door to the statement, and the district court agreed. So Roberto Zamora's confession came in, all of his statements came in, and he clearly confessed that he had acquired that VW from a Mexican. And he had picked it up at the Fiesta store, or at a store down the road, and that he knew that it had cocaine in it. Now, we also have this individual, Gordo, which, as Your Honor points out, in Spanish is a word that means fat or fatty. And there was testimony at trial, elicited on cross-examination, that is not an uncommon nickname, particularly among people that you know well who, you know, don't mind you calling them names like that. But the jury was free to disregard that. And the fact is, Alberto Flores, Ivan Flores, testified that one of the people he met with, when he would drive the car, the VW, or whatever car he was driving, to the Galleria, one of the people he met with was named Gordo. And lo and behold, we have a drug ledger found in Roberto Zamora's house. Fingerprints determined that Roberto Zamora's fingerprints were on the drug ledger, and there were some loose sheets that had been torn out, and they were sort of on the side. His fingerprints were on at least one of the loose sheets. And what name is in the drug ledger as being involved in a transaction but Gordo? Now, Could it be a different person? Possibly. But, you know, on sufficiency review, we weigh all inferences in the light most favorable to the verdict. And the jury heard the cross-examination that it could be someone else and obviously rejected that. So you have the VW. It's the same VW. You have Gordo. You have the drug ledgers. You have Roberto's confession. And then you have this sort of, like I said, overlapping. You know, drug conspiracies, we all know, they operate sort of on a division of labor. And I cite a case, I think, Morris, in my brief to that effect. It's not of that unusual. Defense counsel says, we know none of these people knew him. Well, that was sort of the design. You know, a lot of the witnesses testified with regard to Fletcher Freeman that they would go to a hotel and some third party would come and pick up the cocaine, and they didn't meet Freeman. Now, some of them did meet Freeman, or they would see him from a distance, and they were able to identify him from a lineup. I would suggest that it is not unusual in a drug conspiracy for couriers, particularly lower-level ones, not to be allowed to meet the big end-line customers. And, you know, 4 kilos of powder cocaine is worth over $50,000. That's a big customer. That's a lot of drugs. So I would suggest that it is not at all unusual for not everyone in this conspiracy, or for none of the people in this conspiracy who acted as couriers, to know Mr. Zamora, particularly in light of the evidence that the way they worked was a courier would, in Texas, would go to the Galleria, would park the car, leave the keys in it, go inside, come back 2 hours later, and then take the car someplace else. I mean, that was just the way that these people did business.
Well, what does that mean, that the car had been driven away in the meantime and unloaded and driven back?
Yes, that was the clear suggestion in the...
And that's what appeared to be happening in Fulton Street, I suppose.
Yes, I would suggest that's what was going to happen. That's right. I think it's reasonable to infer from the evidence that someone had picked up that car at the Galleria, had brought it to Fulton Street. At some point, it was going to be unloaded. You know, Roberto is the one who moves that VW under the carport and covers it with a tarp. The testimony was as if he was trying to conceal something. And I cite a fairly general case in my brief that says, you know, sort of the intent to conceal can be considered evidence of guilty knowledge. And so, you know, from all of that evidence, I would suggest the jury could have found, as it did find, that Roberto Zamora was a knowing and willing participant in a single conspiracy that, albeit, involved two significant components, Texas and Georgia.
Okay.
Thank you,
Your
Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Everly?
Three quick points. There really are only five defendants in this case, not 10, I think if you look at it fairly, who implicated the defendant. Puente, Stinson, Cortez, Silva, and Gutierrez. And Gutierrez and Puente give testimony that is impossibly inconsistent with the government's theory of the case and with the testimony of those other three witnesses. Alberto Flores, the one who drove drugs both to Texas and to Georgia, said he does not recognize the defendant. And third is this tow truck driver. It is true that there's no apparent reason why this tow truck driver would want to get on the stand and not tell the truth. But there is still reason to question this man's testimony in light of several things. First of all, apparently what he did was he drove this car, which allegedly had cocaine in it. This cocaine was never seized or anything. And stayed in a hotel, and the next day he met a guy named Joe, and then this other guy pulls up, gives Joe money. Joe gives the money to the tow truck driver for the tow, and he goes home. This guy who shows up apparently is Mr. Freeman. He picks him out of a photo lineup. If you look at this photo lineup, it's almost unbelievable. There's six people in it. One of them has a face that's so blurry, you could. If the question was, could it have been this guy, the answer is going to be, quite honestly, yes, if it was an African-American person, because this person looks like anybody. You can't see the features. The other ones are at least defined enough for you to say, well, no, I don't recognize him.
What was the fee to tow the car that distance?
I'm sorry?
What was the fee paid to tow the vehicle from Lafayette to Columbus, Georgia? That's a pretty long haul.
That's an interesting question, and here's the thing. If you look at the...
Okay, would you first tell me the fee and then tell me why it's there?
I'm not sure what it was, and here's why. I think it was maybe $1,400. It's a vague recollection, and I'm not sure that's correct. In one of these defendants, Julio Cortez, he pleads guilty. He has a factual basis. In that factual basis, he states, or the government states, he wired the money to the Lafayette tow truck place. In other words, you pay in advance. He pays. Apparently, he has wired this money to Lafayette for this guy to drive this truck to Georgia. So my question is, what is this money? It's not clear. He says it was to pay for the tow. That doesn't really make sense. That was another reason why this testimony is a little odd. And then the fact that he picked them out of the, you know, this was years later, he picks them out of the courtroom instantly. But, you know, I mean, he is the defendant. And there was some suggestion by Mr. Freeman himself that, of course, this was never litigated. The court didn't want to hear about it. But Mr. Freeman told his attorney, who told the judge that an attorney for another defendant, co-defendant, who wasn't being tried at the time, told the Mr. Ballard, the tow truck driver, which person was Mr. Freeman. Now, that may or may not be true, but it gives us reason to question whether this tow truck driver's testimony is enough. Thank you. Sorry.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Bevins.
The question before the court is not that Mr. Zamora did something wrong. There's overwhelming evidence that Mr. Zamora was a drug dealer. I believe that the jury at the trial found Mr. Zamora guilty of something. He did something wrong, and he was before the court. Okay. The question raised by the government as to the registration of the Volkswagen, whatever happened to the Volkswagen prior to March 5th, 2005, has absolutely nothing to do with Mr. Zamora. The car, Lieutenant Edward Valdez of the Jim Wells Sheriff's Office in South Texas testified at trial that the car was seized on March 5th, 2005, was forfeited and sold on March 11th, 2005. So the next time we see the VW is in Zamora's yard on April 4th, 2006. So that breaks the connection of Mr. Zamora with the Chapa Duran conspiracy. Mr. Zamora may have been in some other conspiracy. The car was taken out of circulation. So it's definitely a technicality, but it goes to the fact that Mr. Zamora is indicted in this conspiracy. So if the conspiracy charge falls against Mr. Zamora, then the gun charge should also fall. Okay. Again, the government, in their argument, they try to associate Mr. Zamora with the conspiracy on inferences. Like they say, they use the word Gordo. We didn't identify Gordo. Again, the argument, they prove that just because the method of operation of the Duran conspiracy was similar to the operation that Mr. Zamora was involved is not a question, because this is a very common MO to leave the car at the Galleria or leave the car at Fiesta store. I've had cases where both places have been used. It's quite common. So the government's case is totally based on the fact that these inferences and the connection of the VW. So, thank you.
All right, sir, thank you. And Mr. Averly, you're court appointed, and as always, we appreciate your service.